It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk to one of the authors of a new major report on poverty here in Wisconsin. But first, a summit tomorrow in Madison tackles issues of diversity and leadership in the workplace. It's hosted by the Madison Region Economic Partnership and the Urban League of Greater Madison.
Demographers have been telling us for years that the rapidly changing profiles of our communities will bring new customers and demands for new products and services. But what does this mean for businesses?
Our next guest helps companies meet the demands of an increasingly diverse and global marketplace. She's a keynote speaker at tomorrow's conference. She says that business success can hinge on diversity and inclusion in a company's leadership.
Maria Campbell was corporate director of diversity for SC Johnson for more than 20 years. She's the owner of Maria L. Campbell and Associates and trains leaders and companies in diversity and inclusion. Maria, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Well, tomorrow's summit is the first time that the Madison Region Economic Partnership and the Urban League of Greater Madison have joined forces to host an economic summit. What is significant about that, an economic organization teaming up with a community group?
Well, I think it makes sense, given the changes in our workforce and given the dynamics in terms of spending power, that we really focus on the strength and the energy behind the emerging markets, particularly within the U.S. So it makes perfect sense, and I'm really excited to be a part of that conference.
Well, your talk tomorrow is called Leadership Through a New Lens. What new lens are you hoping that we begin to see through?
Well, I think we need to take off the glasses that we have and see the market for what it has emerged to be. And clearly, there are really four things that are impacting this new lens that we now see. The common color amongst diverse consumers has always been green. It continues to be. It would not change in color. We also know that the demographic shifts are here and will continue to be even stronger. We also understand from some key leaders that innovation equates to diversity in terms of different thinking power and different thinking styles. And we also understand that the global economy is here and our ability to understand different cultures is not just about going global or living in different international countries, but that multinational skill representation is right here in the U.S. So when you look at those four dynamics, it encourages all to really take off the glasses we have and look through our market and look to our market differently.
Now, you're talking about diversity being key in business in the future. Mm-hmm. How do you see that playing out?
Well, I see several ways. Number one, I think that business leaders are going to be very clear on what their market opportunities are and who they now serve. And because they are more clear on what that looks like, they will have to change not only how they lead, but the markets they continue to penetrate. And the employees that they have internally will help them keep in touch with that consumer and also reach them to different network opportunities. And I think that particular market would also bridge them to new product ideas, a new innovative way of servicing the client. We understand that we are on a 24/7 eye this, eye that, but we also have wearable technology. So our ability to get information quickly will really be off the chain in terms of what we're seeing moving into the future.
Can you give us an example of what you just talked about in action?
Well, I think when you talk about how you now do market research, it's important that you ensure that your focus groups are inclusive. You want to make sure that they have representation from different groups. You also want to make sure that as you're doing your advertising, that your actors on the screen represent who are looking at you. So you want to have a relationship with your advertising firm to make sure your print and also the actors that I see on the TV look like me. You also want to begin to ask your market research to look at different marketing neighborhood segmentations. And even packaging and different colors and fragrances attract different multicultural consumers differently. So I think those are some ideas specific to the marketing piece that will be important moving forward. I also think we know that what we're doing in the community in terms of giving back really attracts the millennial groups, and people are really concerned about how we are impacting our earth. So it's not just about the job and the money. It is about how we're doing the best for our environment and making an impact.
Until very recently, topics like diversity, inclusion have been kind of relegated to a particular department or maybe someone whose job that was in the company to look at that thing. But how do you say that companies you do say companies can no longer really afford to keep on doing that. What should they be doing to meet the needs of the community and the economy and get it out, you know, past these little silos into the business and the community?
Well, I think that if you look at historically, diversity in its leadership has been aligned into HR. And that's not bad or wrong or right or wrong. It's just how it has played out in terms of it's been positioning. But companies that are really looking at this holistically have moved the responsibility to diversity out of HR and really attached it to the higher C-suite leaders because they're taking a holistic view of it. So it's not just about building your work talent, but it is about how does this competency of diversity and leadership through it impact all facets of business. And because it is elevated to a different level, it is then mainstreamed into everything that we do to be successful as a company.
Now, we've been hearing lately a lot about how upper management, what you're calling the C-suite, doesn't necessarily reflect the diversity that might be the clientele. How much does that matter?
Well, I think it continues to be a challenge, and it continues to be the reality of what corporate America is. But I think as we pursue diversity and inclusion, we need to send the message that it is not just about a few, but it is about a collective all. And no one is asking anyone that is in the C-suite that may, you know, that may not be of a different ethnic group to leave that space or to say that you have done something bad. But what we are saying is that there's more seats at the table, so please move over to allow more chairs to come in to give better solutions and to help you as a leader move forward.
One point you make to get your point across is that dominant companies have developed a kind of footprint of diversity and inclusion that fits into their business. What is this footprint?
The footprint really looks at, you know, talent, marketing, and this community or sustainability. So it takes a whole window view, if you will, of why it's important to our business, not just from a workplace standpoint, but also what we need to do from a marketing and a community opportunity to really grow this. Companies understand, for example, that supply diversity is a key component to driving community and economic development because most of the businesses that are emerging, minority or women businesses that are emerging, they're bringing almost $3 trillion of revenue to different cities. And who are they employing? They're probably reaching out to the community as to employ those residents. So it's a ripple effect in terms of the power that this can bring to not only the community, but to all of us.
Now, you've said that diversity inclusion, it's less about what leaders do, and it's more about how they lead. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, I think, you know, traditionally you will hear, you know, well, tell me what to do, and well, tell me how to get this done, and if this doesn't work, then please give me two more things, because I only have time to really look at two or three things. And I think moving forward, what companies and leaders have really understood, it's not about what you need to do, but it is about how you now lead. So it becomes now a competency that you focus in on versus a checklist approach. Diversity, evidently, you know, good or bad, it is not going away because our market now represents who we have become. So it becomes not about give me a checklist on what to do, but now how I build competencies on how I now lead in a market that is now very diverse.
And we'll leave it there, Maria. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Maria Campbell. She's speaking at an event tomorrow in Wisconsin on diversity and leadership.
The UW's Institute for Research on Poverty just released its Wisconsin Poverty Report, the sixth annual report of the Wisconsin Poverty Project. While it shows poverty rates are going down, jobs still aren't at pre-recession levels.
The report also says social safety net programs are still needed to keep people out of poverty, and it highlights pockets about poverty around the state.
Tim Smeeting is with us now. He's director of the Institute for Research on Poverty and the Arts and Sciences Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs at the La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Tim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be on again.
Well, the Wisconsin Poverty Report, as we said, shows the poverty level continued to drop in the Badger State. When did we see it going down after the Great Recession?
Well, it turns out that the difference with it's been pretty low. It's hovered around 10, below 11% for the last 3 years now, and it's at 10.2 now. But the big difference this year from the earlier years is this year it fell because of the labor market, not just because of the programs. So in other words, what we call market income poverty, which is income that you generate from your own means. It could be from rent or dividends or pension, but mainly it's from your own earnings, actually fell. That's the first time since 2008. That means that we are starting to pick up steam. There are more jobs. And for the first time, the job situation improved enough to help reduce the poverty rate. And then, of course, the income support system, particularly the food share program or food stamps or SNAP, whatever you want to call it here, and refundable tax credits really help too.
And this may sound like a fine point, but you measure poverty differently than the federal government does. What do you do different, and why is it important to do it?
Well, for a long time, many of us, including my chancellor, Becky Blank, and I, who played an instrumental role, particularly Becky, but also I, in creating the federal supplemental poverty measure. And the Wisconsin poverty measure is similar. What that means is that we look at taxes. We include the in-kind benefits that we spend a lot of money on and have a lot of people enrolled in Wisconsin, like food share and the earned income credit. We base the poverty line on what a low-income family spends. If we're going to give you the earned income tax credit because you went to work to supplement your earnings, we're going to also have to look at what it costs you to go to work, so we adjust for the cost of going to work, including travel and child care. If the poverty line is based only on food, clothing, and shelter, you don't have a lot left over to spend for something like big medical bills, so we subtract those. Then we do a lot of things. We count cohabitors as couples so that you know, they are really sharing resources. We throw out students who have no earnings. Otherwise, Madison poverty looks much higher because you've got a lot of people living out here in the community who are students who are fairly well-to-do, but I didn't earn anything last year. I only earned $500 last year. So we don't want them in the universe. We adjust for differences in cost of living because if it costs you $1 to live in Wisconsin on average, it costs $1.10 in Madison and $1.15 in some suburbs of Milwaukee and only 90 cents up in Superior. So we do all of those things to make this measure tell us about the programs that we invest in to help reduce poverty. The official measure does not include the food stamp program. It doesn't include taxes people pay or refundable taxes they get back. That's just ridiculous.
And some of those things keep people out of poverty.
They sure as hell do. And we should all be happy as Wisconsinites that we have this safety net, and it works, and it continues to work. What this year's report shows is, starting now and on forward, we're going to need to rely on that safety net less as the private market picks up. So, for instance, about 1 million people were on the SNAP program for the year we did this report in Wisconsin. Now there's only 850,000 on the program as of last month. So the roles are falling. We haven't gotten there yet. And jobs are growing. We've shown in the report that while we lost at least 150,000 jobs in Wisconsin, we got about 75,000 of them back. So it's not like we're all the way back. But you're starting to see the effect of increasing employment and starting to reduce poverty. But we have one more problem. That is, the jobs we're creating that low-income people take are low-wage service sector jobs that don't have benefits and don't pay enough to support a family. So that's why we still need the safety net. It's great that you've gone out and your earnings are $7,000, $8,000, $10,000, but you can't support your family with that. And if your earnings go from $8,000 to $10,000, you get a little more from the earned income tax credit, which is good, but then your food stamp amounts will fall because you don't need as much because your income is higher. So the system works together to help reduce poverty. The difference this year is it's the labor market that's just starting to show its effects on poverty, and that's good. The long-run solution to poverty is a decent job that pays wages, not an income support program.
Do you see that trend continuing? More jobs and maybe gradually better-paying jobs?
Yes. Well, I see more jobs. And I see more jobs now in the employment numbers than the period when this report ended in November 2012. Next year we'll go through 2013. It's the most recent data we've got. And I can see that in the period we looked at this year, about 20,000 more jobs in Wisconsin, and another 20,000 for that period next year. I mean, that's not enough jobs to start with. But then the issue is what kind of jobs? And we need more and better jobs. We all, I think we all agree that that's what we have to do. We have to find ways to get employers in the game saying, well, I want a worker who can do X, Y, and Z, and then say, okay, we'll get you a worker who can do X, Y, and Z, but then have the job for them at the end. Because training somebody to be a welder or a nurse's assistant or whatever and not having a job at the other end is a big waste of their time and a big waste of our money, and it's very, very discouraging. So we need employers to be more involved in providing jobs. I even believe in something that conservatives call, and I call, the jobs of last resort, which means that if you're worried about a single individual who's on food stamps and says they can't find a job, fine, give them a job. Subsidize a private sector employer to provide a job for this person for 6 months and then give them another subsidy if they're still there at the end of the year. And then that person either has to take that job or they don't get benefits anymore. Most likely that job won't be enough. They'll still probably get some food share or food stamps. But the benefits, you know, will go down. In other words, both the worker will be better off and we'll save some money on food stamps.
Well, I wanted to ask, on the social safety net side, the government has control over what it does there. On the job market side, though, I mean, apart from incentives like you were just talking about, isn't that just a variable outside of the government's control?
Well, in some ways it is. Some states, like Minnesota, have done very well at job creation, and Colorado have both done very well at job creation coming out of the recession. We're 40th in the country. I got the feeling that we're waiting for manufacturing jobs to come back, and they're not going to. Manufacturing employment in this country has been dropping for 40 years, and it's still falling, and it will continue to fall. We need other newer and better ways of getting people involved in higher skill personal services, you know, that serve the people I'm talking about. We're talking about people who don't have a four-year degree. People have a four-year degree. We have EPICS and other good businesses that are growing rapidly now, and those people were doing okay. We're talking about workers who used to be able to walk into a construction job or used to be able to walk into a manufacturing job and can't do that anymore. And we're particularly talking about minority men, who is a big part of this group, and people who are the ex-incarcerated. These are special groups. We can help these groups get jobs, but we have to make an effort, and we're going to have to fund it. We have to continue our technical college training, but to have employers linked to it that say that, okay, if you learn X, Y, and Z, I'll give you a job. And as we recover, more employers should be gaining the confidence to be able to do this.
On the social safety net side, again, a criticism of some programs anyway is that if you're giving people money or benefits while they're not working, is that an incentive to not go to work, not look for work? Are there programs that don't do that, that overcome that criticism?
Yes, there are. So, for instance, people say, well, if you're getting food stamps or food share, you have a disincentive to work because if you earn a dollar, you're going to lose 30 cents of those food benefits. But those food benefits aren't enough on your own to get by. And if you may pay 30 cents more for food stamps if you earn a dollar, but you'll get a dollar back from the earned income tax credit. In other words, a much larger amount back from the earned income tax credit than you'll lose from food share. And people want to be self-reliant. America is about jobs. Self-respect is about jobs. People who get the earned income tax credit say, it ain't like I'm poor. I worked and I earned those benefits. And we want to keep that going. We just want to find a better job so that at some point they can move beyond the earned income credit. So I think we've far, far overstated the case about discouraging work with a program like SNAP or Food Share, which gives you, by the way, $29 a week total for food.
We're talking about poverty with Timothy Smeeting of the Institute for Research on Poverty. The newly released Wisconsin Poverty Report tracks trends in Wisconsin. Things are getting a little better since the Great Recession. The job situation is starting to get a little better, lift people out of poverty. Still a lot of room for improvement, though, he says. Coming up, we'll talk about some pockets of poverty around the state.
And we want to hear what you're seeing in your community. Do you see poverty rates going down where you live? What kind of economic indicators are you seeing? Do you agree that we need to keep social safety net programs? Why or why not? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Continuing our conversation with Timothy Smeeting, Director of the Institute for Research on Poverty at the UW. He's with us to talk about the Wisconsin Poverty Report.
We want to hear what you're seeing in your community. Are you in a high poverty area? Do you think things are getting better or worse where you live? What would you like to see from the state or federal governments when it comes to dealing with poverty-related issues? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@WPR.org. Tim, in your report, you also look at pockets of poverty, higher poverty areas around the state. Where are we talking about?
We're talking about Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. We're talking about Madison. We're talking about the Superior region. And it turns out that, for instance, we've all read the recent Casey's report about how poorly black children do in Wisconsin. Well, you can see that in this report, too. The report itself doesn't have it, but in my presentation, I showed a map, for instance, of child poverty within Milwaukee County. Child poverty within Milwaukee County goes from 53% in the center of the city to 2.3% in Cedarburg and Whitefish Bay. That's within the same county. In Madison, the poverty rate inside Madison itself is about 29%, despite the fact that Dane County is much lower, maybe 12 or 13%. And the west side and east side do a little bit better, but there are big pockets of poverty in this state, many of them which include an awful lot of young blacks and their parents.
So these segregated geographically and ethnically areas, why are they such concentrated pockets of poverty?
Well, there's more joblessness among African Americans. There's more out-of-wedlock childbirth. Kids come to school less well-prepared, less well-fed. They have a more difficult time in schools. They get shuffled into the not best schools. Their parents have their children quite often when they're very young before they finish their own schooling or found a partner. So, you know, keeping your head above water is difficult. So that's a huge issue. And it's not just the schools which are having a hard time. It's it's who comes to the schools and the problems and the issues that they bring with them, and the need for follow-through, and so on. And that's very concentrated in Wisconsin. It's concentrated in parts of Milwaukee and parts of Madison mainly.
And how can policies target those areas and those problems you just mentioned?
Well, I have some people I'm talking with here in Madison who are calling that a grand challenge, which I think it is a grand challenge. It's going to take more work with young women, for instance, to make sure that if you had your first child when you were a teenager, you don't have another one. It's going to take intelligent use of contraceptives. It's going to take lots of other prompts, programs, and mentoring to tell you that the best thing to do at this stage is to stay in school and graduate if you want to be a successful adult and not have a child before you're 20 or before you're 25. That's the number one thing. But then, of course, we do have a lot of children in that situation, so now we have to work on providing them more opportunity. It starts with healthcare delivery. The healthcare system is the main social institution with which poor kids are, you know, exposed to between birth and age two. And a physician should know if the mother's health status, the mother's pregnancy, how it went, whether the mother is depressed or not, and so forth, because you can't just treat the child alone there. You have to treat the child as part of a family, and it's usually with the mother. Then we have to get higher quality preschool programs for these kids. So when they do get to kindergarten and they do get to school, they're ready to learn. And then we have to mentor them and tell them that if you want to be an X or a Y or a Z, you have to take that math course and you have to take this exam. And don't worry, you can afford to go to college if you're well prepared and all of that. So it's going to take a while. But there's a role to be played by physicians, by early childhood educators, by educators, by the food security system, because kids who show up in school hungry don't learn very well, and I could go on.
And you also mentioned Superior. Why is that a poverty, a high poverty area?
It's, you know, sort of hard scrabble. It's hard poverty as we measure it. Let me put it this way. It's a hard scrabble area. You know, a lot of jobs have left, and the jobs that are there are much more intermittent. The logging industry isn't what it was before the recession. But here's the problem there. This is the problem with definitions, okay? I do think we've got big poverty problems in Madison and in Milwaukee, and they're definitely associated with race, and we definitely have to do something about them. But you go up there to Superior, and you got some guy who makes $13,000 a year, hunts and shoots his own food, heats his house, you know, with firewood. And if you go tell that guy that you're poor, he'll shoot you. All right? So our standards for measuring poverty in central city areas don't always fit really well in rural areas. People make do with what they've got. They scrape to get by, and they hang together. There's nobody else there to hang with. It's just to say that the area is not booming. The jobs there aren't paying as much as they used to. And, you know, the benefits probably aren't as plentiful there either.
We'll go to our phones now. We've got Daniel with us in Cuba City. Daniel, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I actually like to agree that I do believe that there are some that are racially poverty areas. But also in, like, the rural communities, like, not just the large cities, but there's actual smaller schools where 50 to 60% of their people that come to school are subsidized lunch or free lunches. And that there's not the jobs that used to be in, like, the rural communities as there are compared to larger cities.
Daniel, thanks for bringing that up. Tim, are there strategies for tackling rural poverty in areas that are different than what we might do in an urban area?
Nope. Your caller hit his finger right on the pulse. It's exactly right. A lot of rural areas used to depend on particular industries, forestry, wood turning, and now they're drying up. As those jobs dry up, you know, there's nothing for kids, so kids grow up and they move away. And the rural areas are in a really difficult situation. And so then when kids who are left there who go to school do get free school lunch and school breakfast because their families don't have much. They're staying there because other relatives are there. They're staying there in hopes that they'll find some sort of employment. But it's really hard for families in rural areas to say, okay, let's pack it up. I know you've got a job. Your wife's got a job that makes $20,000 a year, and you can't find work. It's pretty risky to say, okay, let's load the kids into the truck and move to Madison and give up the one job that one has and the other doesn't. And I think this is true in rural areas all over the world and all over the United States. Now, if you have a big mining thing or if you have oil shale or tar sands like in the Dakotas, or if you happen to have a prison in your city or if you have a medical center or something like that that helps hold it together, but there aren't many big, fancy new industries, many knowledge-based industries, many high-tech industries opening in rural areas. You have places like the Fox River Valley where you've got an agglomeration. And those are cities which feed off of each other and have good light manufacturing and some high-tech stuff going on, which is really good, the same in a few other areas of the state. But out in the middle of nowhere, it really gets much, much more difficult. You've got the tourist industry that's good for maybe half a year, and maybe some small enterprises, but the areas aren't growing. Jobs are falling, wages are falling, and people are getting desperate. So I totally agree with the guy from Cuba City.
So you've been doing this report. It's an annual report. What are you hoping policymakers do with the information you put out?
Well, I hope that they say, okay, we got to pay some attention to the quality of jobs here. First of all, I want them, and cheer all the people in Wisconsin. We have a good safety net. It works here. In this report, we show you how much the food share program and the earned income credit reduce poverty in our state. We should be proud of that. We're compassionate people. We help people at the bottom. But to get them off the bottom and get them lifted up, you got to give them better than 20 hours a week for $8 an hour at Walmart. You got to do better than that. We have to be able to find more opportunities for them to work with better pay, maybe with some flexible hours, at higher wages. I'm a fan of increasing the minimum wage, not to $15 an hour, but slowly going up to 10. The Congressional Budget Office has shown that maybe 500,000 people in America would lose their jobs if we raise the minimum wage. But they also showed that another 16.5 million would get paid more per hour for every hour that they work. Now, that's a trade-off I'm willing to accept. Yes, we're going to lose a few jobs, but 30 times as many people are going to be making higher wages, and that will allow them to do a much better job taking care of their families. It will save us money on employee turnover. It will save us money on the food stamp program, and so on. So that we need to pay more attention to labor markets and building jobs. We're in the right direction. The gov promised 250. I would have told him to not promise anything because a lot of it's out of his control. But there are things we can do at the margin to grow faster and grow smarter. John Terenius and Tom Hefty wrote in the WIPRI Journal some good ideas last month. They believe, as I do, that we're on the right track, but we're moving real slow.
We'll leave it there. Tim, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you, Rob and Veronica. I enjoyed it.
That was Timothy Smeeting, director of the Institute for Research on Poverty and professor of public affairs at UW-Madison. You are our guest. Earlier this week, we learned from Gretchen Reynolds that walking can boost our creativity.
Well, now we want you to call in and share your favorite place to go for a walk in Wisconsin. Maybe when you need to clear your head, just find some peace and quiet, or maybe when you're looking to get a little more creative. What is your go-to walking spot here in Wisconsin? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Yeah, if you have a place, a city or country, a walk in the woods or in a prairie, alone, family, walking a pet, let us know a great place to take a walk. Again, the number you can call in now, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us. We're at Central Time WPR. We heard from Robin, who tweeted us. She recommends the Driftless region anywhere on the west coast of Wisconsin. And I like the walk along the river in La Crosse. Actually, that's for western Wisconsin. That's a nice, you're right in the city. A lot of stuff you can go to from there, but it's really beautiful along the river there too.
Yeah, walks along bodies of water.
Yeah.
Oh, is excellent. I'm totally partial to the walk in Big Bay State Park on Madeline Island. Mm-hmm. Along, it goes right along Lake Superior, kind of up high, and you can hear the waves crashing. It's stunning.
I have done that one, too. That is a great one. Well, let's get our callers in on this. We've got David starting us off in Green Bay. David, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, where do you go walking?
I go walking downtown Green Bay along Broadway, sometimes over the river on Washington, and they're redeveloped downtown.
Any places you like to stop along the way?
Oh, there's a lot of places. There's Bernstein's Candies, a couple taverns. But usually it's just to walk. I kind of like that urban feel.
And do you go out? Do you work down there? Do you get out to clear your head during work or just go down, visit, and walk?
I live down there, so I kind of just go for some exercise, but also just kind of get away and clear my head and relax.
Beautiful. David, thanks for calling in and sharing that walk with us.
Yeah, thanks much for that. It's interesting because when I think of walk, I usually think nature, but there are lots of urban walks that we can take that are pretty fantastic, too. We're going to go next to Donna in Friendship. Hi, Donna.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to walk at the Nisida National Wildlife Refuge in Nisida, Wisconsin.
What do you like about that?
Well, it offers a lot of different types of habitat. You get the woodlands, you get the wetland, and you get the open savannas. They have several nice trails that are mowed, and then they also have some accessible trails that have boardwalks and gravel on them, and they actually intersect with some of the wetlands.
Great. A lot of variety, Donna. Do you have a favorite time of year to go there?
I go there year round.
Okay.
I think probably now through October would be my favorite time.
All right.
That location.
Thanks a lot for sharing that, Donna. We are asking you to share your favorite places to walk in Wisconsin. Keep trying if you're getting a busy signal. Lines are opening up now and again. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we're going to go next to Katie in Manitowoc. Hey, Katie.
Hi.
What do you think about
walking? I like to walk along the Mariner Trail in between Manitowoc and Two Rivers. It's right on the lake shore, and it's just a very beautiful and scenic walk.
Well, that sounds nice, the Mariner Trail. So lots of views of the lake then, I'm guessing.
Yep, it's right along the lake shore.
Perfect.
Is that a rugged walk up and down, or are you pretty much on a flat beach the whole way?
You can walk along the beach. Otherwise, there's a paved trail that you can walk on as well.
Cool.
That sounds gorgeous. Well, thank you so much. We should be writing these down because I like walks. Oh, well.
Next time, let's remember to write down suggestions and we could like post them or
brilliant.
Something.
Wow. You're brilliant, Rob. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Revolutionize radio.
Let's go next to Anne, who's joining us in Neenah. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to mention one of my favorite places is South Woods in Ripon, Wisconsin. And they're having their annual spring walk. And they have guides that take you through the woods and point out different wildflowers. It's a real undisturbed woods, old-growth woods. It's absolutely beautiful. Parts of it I don't think has ever even been logged, so it's very old.
Wow, that sounds really lovely. So
tons of spring flowers, something you've never seen before in huge, huge bunches.
So South Woods in Ripon, Wisconsin. That's another one. Thank you so much, Anne. I appreciate that call.
We'll go to Rebecca now in Milwaukee. Rebecca, hi.
Hi.
Where do you like to go walking?
Well, I live in Milwaukee, and right in the middle of the city is Havenwood State Forest, 237 acres. For years, I didn't even tell anybody about it, but it's such a treasure. It's got some ponds and a creek, and it's got a gravel path, but lots of just woods and wide open prairie, and it's marvelous. I've seen salmon. There's reports of mink. I've seen deer, fox, and lots of birds.
Wait, this is in Milwaukee?
In Milwaukee, between the National Guard Armory and a public housing project.
Hmm.
And they've been working to restore it for 25 years.
Are they trying to keep this kind of on the down low, Rebecca, or is this something that people are just discovering and going to?
I don't think they're trying to keep it on the down low. I just don't think there's a lot of maybe budget to get the information out there. But they have an active, group of friends of the Havenwoods and activities, lots of youth activities. I'm a college teacher. I've taken classes out there. There are lots of public schools, I think, that take their kids out there. So it's really a special treasure.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing that, Rebecca. We're taking your suggestions for great walks in Wisconsin. We'll go now to Kevin in Tomahawka. Before we go to Kevin, still time for you to call in 800-642-1234. Kevin, what walk do you want to share with us?
Well, you were saying, well, walk with your pet, and anywhere I can walk with my dog is absolutely my favorite. But my second favorite is the Harrison Hills in Tomahawk. It's just a gorgeous trail that you can walk miles and miles and never see another human being. There's lakes, and it's just a fantastic, quiet experience.
That sounds great. And Kevin, Michelle, our board operator, is from that area, and she likes the Bearskin Trail between Minocqua and Tomahawk. Have you walked that?
I have. I've actually snowmobiled it, too. It's an old railroad bed, and it goes through some very nice area. But like I said, in Harrison, you're secluded. You don't ever see another human being out there. But now you might.
Now that you've given away the secret. Kevin, thank you so much for sharing that with us.
Okay, and moving on, we go to Lori next in Oconomowoc. Hi, Lori.
Hi there.
Hey.
I think a really great walk is the walk around Fowler Lake here in Oconomowoc.
Ah, Fowler Lake. All right, I'm not familiar with that. What might I see if I were taking a walk around Fowler Lake?
Well, one of the things that you would enjoy at the end of your walk is a stop at the gelato shop or at Whelan's Coffee Shop, which has ice cream as well. But during your walk, you could possibly see loon, and also bald eagles are in this area as well.
If that's the Oconomowoc Lake I'm thinking about, it's a pretty big lake. How long a walk is that if you walk all the way around it? Or are you just talking about a little stroll along the shore?
No, I'm talking, there's several lakes out in this area, but I'm talking about Fowler Lake in particular, which will take you through beautiful little neighborhoods and then also through our downtown area.
Okay, I think that is the one. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. We've had some people on Facebook chiming in, by the way. Patty wrote Baxter Hollow, Pine Hollow, and Bourne's Hollow. He likes the hollows. I haven't been to any of those.
I have been to Baxter Hollow, and it is pretty spectacular.
Where is that? I didn't even know.
It's near Baraboo.
Okay.
I think I've got that right. North of Sauk City.
Okay.
Anyway, if you hit it at the wrong season, it's more mosquitoes than you've ever encountered in your entire life, but it is spectacularly beautiful. So I second that. Carly on Facebook says Devil's Lake, Baird's Creek in Green Bay, UW Green Bay Arboretum, and the Madison Arboretum, and a place called Trip Falls.
Thanks for all those suggestions, Carly. We've got Diane and Racine on the line now. Diane, hi there.
Hi. I really wanted to recommend the Petrified Springs County Park in Kenosha County. It has lots and lots of trails through the woods. It has paved paths for handicapped. It's dog friendly, and there's water to walk by. There's woods to walk through. I have been greeted by deer on the trail walking my dog. It's just wonderful.
It's called Petrified Springs Park.
Yep.
What's a petrified spring?
It's right off of 31.
So what's the petrified part? I don't know.
Everything's moving when I'm there.
Maybe some people were frightened of the deer the first time, and they're just petrified. And so they spring away.
Yeah,
I'm reaching.
There is something back in. I know we have an Indian Springs Trail as one of the trails back there. So there could be lots of reasons for the name.
Awesome.
The woman in Kenosha County can answer that. I just love the park.
Diane, thank you so much for that suggestion.
And thank you, everybody, for all of these great suggestions for places to walk in Wisconsin. Now we know that walking isn't just good for you. It helps boost creativity, as we heard earlier this week with Gretchen Reynolds. Well, you can share your ideas. Keep them coming on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet them at Central Time WPR.
Coming up, we'll hear about the secret lives of plants, from the truth about plant sex to the quest for the black petunia. I'm Rob Ferrick.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.